That's me, Steve-O. Welcome to Tide Smart Talk. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310. Happy New Year, Deb.
Happy New Year.
This is Saturday, January 2nd. It's our first show of 2016.
Sure is.
How long does it take you to remember to write out your checks and everything with 16 instead of 15?
I got to tell you, it takes me about a good 30 days.
Yeah, I give myself till February.
Do you?
Yeah.
Good for you.
Anyhow, we have a very special guest, an interview that we recorded a few days ago. So in the interest of getting to that interview, God, on this day, very little on this day content.
Yeah.
Not much happened on this day, apparently. January 2nd over history hasn't really yielded big events.
Not very impressive.
Not very impressive. Cuba Gooding Jr. turns 48. Show Me the Money from Jerry Maguire.
Yes.
Love that guy. Great actor. Anyhow, why don't we get to the interview, because I'm always interested in climate change discussions, also interested in the Gulf of Maine. And with that, why don't we launch the interview we did a few days ago with Don Perkins, who's the president and CEO of Gulf of Maine Research Institute.
All right.
Somewhere beyond the sea, somewhere waiting for me, my lover stands on golden sand.
Well, welcome back. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve on News Talk WLOB 1310 AM. Beyond the Sea.
Great song.
You know, we're going to find out exactly, but I think the ocean comprises 70-80% of the Earth. So really,
yes,
it's not a land mass. It's a water mass with a little bit of land.
That's what I'm learning.
So with that music and the extent of my knowledge on the Earth, let me welcome our guest, Don Perkins. Don is the president and CEO of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute. Welcome, Don.
Thank you, Steve.
Was I close? In terms of water mass, in terms of the Earth?
Two-thirds of the surface of the Earth is ocean. They should have called it Planet Ocean.
I know. Right, Deb? We talk about that all the time.
Yes, we do.
And before we get going, I want to talk about everything that's going on in the ocean, specifically the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, where you all focus on this region, but I think you're research and your understanding goes across the Earth, because everything is kind of interconnected. But before we do that, why don't we spend a couple minutes just talking about your background, what led you to becoming the CEO of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute? Did you grow up in Maine, where you went to school? Then how'd you end up with the Research Institute?
Great. Well, I was born in Waterville. I grew up in Cape Elizabeth, spent a lot of time on the water, and basically, I love the ocean, and over the course of time, that led me back here to get involved starting GMRI.
And somewhere along the way you got a degree at Dartmouth and then an MBA from Stanford, right?
Mm-hmm.
So academically, you were kind of underachieving a little bit between those institutions.
Yeah, I worked hard to keep up.
Well, so talk a little bit about, for people that aren't familiar with Gulf of Maine Research Institute, I guess start at the base point. You know, it seems kind of intuitive that Gulf of Maine would be the ocean area right in front of Maine, but I think it extends a little further than that in terms of the Atlantic. So why don't we start with defining what is the Gulf of Maine, and then let's talk about the Research Institute, and then bigger issues like climate and acidity and water temperature and things that are really vital to all of us.
Well, the Gulf of Maine is the body of water that sits in between Cape Cod and Nova Scotia. It stretches up into the Bay of Fundy, and it from a kind of a system point of view, the way it all functions, it stretches out over Georgia's Bank. So it's about 120 miles from the coast of Maine out to the outer edge of Georgia's Bank. It's about the same distance from Cape Cod to Yarmouth, Nova Scotia. And then it also involves the watershed. So all of Maine, parts of New Hampshire, northeastern Massachusetts, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, the rivers and streams that flow into the Gulf of Maine.
And that's a big part of, I know that I've actually, with our guest Don Perkins, you did a TEDx talk a few years ago, and I watched that the other day, and I thought it was really fascinating. You pronounce it ecosystem. Others have pronounced it ecosystem. Given the fact that you have a degree from both Dartmouth and Stanford, I will go with your ruling here. Is it echo or ecosystem, or is it just potato to potato?
It's like scallops versus scallops. It's wherever you came from.
Okay. So, but I mean, the freshwater interface, given that the watershed area, particularly in Maine and also in New Hampshire, I think New Hampshire only has like 13 miles of coastline or something.
19.
Off again.
Don't cheat him.
Off again. Where's the research? Sully, you know, you said 18. But where fresh water interfaces with salt water creates its own ecosystem that's kind of interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. So you have, I mean, so fresh water is important because it brings nutrients off the land into the ocean. It also is habitat for a lot of important species like salmon and alewives and eels and whatnot that connect the ocean and the uplands. And then along the coast, you have the area, the estuaries, where the fresh water comes into the salt water, and it's less salty. It's like the nursery bed for the Gulf of Maine. So you have, you know, clams and oysters and worms and lots of juvenile fish that come in for habitat to kind of grow out of their being very small critters to larger. So I think of it as the nursery ground or the greenhouse for the ocean.
Yeah. Well, as CEO of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, why don't you talk a little bit about the organization? Where is the organization based? What's the mandate? We'll talk a little bit about how it's funded, whether it's through grants or through private funding, and then we'll talk about kind of the mission of what you all do.
Great. So the Gulf of Maine Research Institute is located in Portland, Maine. Our work really reaches from Cape Cod over to Nova Scotia and up the watershed. Our focus is on the kind of intersection of how do you sustain the Gulf of Maine as an ecosystem and how do you use it as an economic engine. It's an extraordinarily productive ecosystem, and our interest is, you know, how can you fish it, how can you use it for energy and other resources over time, and at the same time take care of it.
So what is the staff made of? You know, it sounds like there's both a business and an economic element that mm-hmm. you must have people mm-hmm. looking at that. Then you also must have scientists, because at its core, marine science is what really kind of drives both the eco or ecosystem and also the economy of mm-hmm. this fishery.
So we have a staff of about 65 individuals, annual budget of about $10 million a year. We have three kind of functional groups of staff. We have an interdisciplinary team of scientists. We have a very talented group of educators who are particularly capable in terms of using technology to make science engaging and accessible for kids and teachers. And then we have a group that works on the community side, the economic development and you know, how do fisheries work as a business, and from a policy point of view, how do you manage fisheries successfully over time?
When the Gulf of Maine Aquarium first arrived mm-hmm. on the scene, mm-hmm. were you part of it then?
Yes. It arrived on the scene well before I got involved. The entity was incorporated in 1968 as a research consortium. It morphed into an aquarium inspired by the New England Aquarium when it was built down in Boston.
Right.
And then I got involved in 1994 to take one of several periodic looks at the viability of an aquarium, and suggested that there was a need for a research capability here in Maine that focused on the Gulf of Maine, and that was 21 years ago, and that's kind of when the path back to a research institute started.
So there's no longer an aquarium there.
We have a lovely aquarium in our education facility,
okay.
but we are not a public aquarium.
Okay.
Yeah.
So like a small aquarium with like 8 fish, or is it a scientific aquarium where you're actually doing a little bit of research? Or
so we have on the education side, we have a digital research lab in our lab in which we host about 10,000 fifth and sixth grade students every year. We see about 70% of the state's middle schools. It doesn't matter whether they come from Fort Kent or Eastport or Falmouth. We've benefited from tremendous corporate support to get to kids and teachers at an age, fifth and sixth grade, when they typically start to bail out of math and science. And our objective is to get them turned on to science, engaged with science, and to assist teachers in upping their game, both in terms of how they teach science and how they use technology. And so in that virtual lab, we have a lovely aquarium that's part of the research experience that kids go through when they're at our lab.
Well, I mean, that gives a local resource, but the New England Aquarium down in Boston is also pretty spectacular, isn't it?
It's fabulous, yeah.
We go down there,
been there. It's great.
Once a year, and it's just fantastic. They've got the, I think they're seals, but on the outside wall, they've got this heavy plexiglass. And so if you just want to walk by, just being close to, and I don't want to derail into an area that's really not your area of oversight, but there's a lot of talk specifically with SeaWorld, which is a different type of kind of tourism experience in terms of killer whales. And I've kind of evolved in the last few years on that.
Yeah.
Where have you seen, what was it called, Blackfish? I think, I don't know if it was a documentary on CNN about how, not for research, but for killer whales at SeaWorld in captivity, just not a good idea.
I haven't seen the documentary yet.
Yeah,
I've
and as a kid,
it.
My family would take us to SeaWorld and Disney World, and you'd see these giant mammals, right? Same classification as humans. And what's your thought on killer whales on display, Don? I know that's not your area, it's the Gulf of Maine research, but...
Yeah, it's an interesting question. So we made a very clear choice 17, 18 years ago to shift from an aspiration to develop an aquarium where we'd put live animals on display to developing a research institute. And the education side of what we do is targeted to middle school students, and the goal is to take kids deep and to really engage them with science, and over time drive Maine's emergence
so
as a
more academic
state.
Than entertainment.
It's about learning. So aquariums, and this is true of museums as well, they're fabulous edutainment. You learn something, but it's first and foremost it's entertainment. And so first you got to make the choice of whether you want to be in the entertainment business or the education business. And then on the entertainment side, to your point, when you're holding, you know, very large fish or mammals, you have to make an ethical decision about whether, you know, it's appropriate to keep those animals in captivity or not. And we're seeing an increasing, I think, public tide of opinion where it's not ethical, and hence you're seeing places, aquariums and more commercial places like SeaWorld start to make the choice to figure out how to let those animals go.
And I think there's even a broader discussion that it not just... fish and not just the ocean, but, you know, everything from Ringling Brothers and elephants, you know, and again, I think it's a positive change, but I think there's a little more awareness that we're all animals. We all have to respect life, whether it's human or whether it, and I'd like to see more thoughtfulness and mindfulness in terms of, you know, the idea of some of these animals in captivity and how, in many ways, they're just being exploited for kind of base entertainment. Yeah.
Zoos the same way.
Yeah, zoos. And again, I think when it is about education, I think that the reason why, to Don's point, why I think that what they do over at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, we need to create understanding. We need to have scientific research, but we also need to stimulate the imagination of young people to understand these things. So that may be a future pursuit academically, but the big animals and...
Well, it was my understanding that they have zoos so that everyday people can see animals they would probably never see in their lifetime. Same thing with aquariums,
that,
you know?
They do. And I think, you know, we're simply seeing a public policy and a public values discussion of questioning, okay, you know, where do you draw the line? And it's a, you know, there's no right or wrong to it. I think it's simply, it's kind of a public ethical discussion.
I'll go with there's wrong when it comes to whales and elephants. Okay. You know, other animals, I think, there's different cases, but based in terms of size and discomfort and the research done with whales who are used to the ocean to swim around, to put them in such a small contained space, and there's been a lot of research where it really kind of, it drives them crazy. You know, they use, again, this is out of my depth, but they use, you know, active sonar in sonar in terms of how they navigate. Mm-hmm. And when all those signals are bouncing off the walls, literally many of these beautiful, majestic creatures are just kind of going crazy in captivity. Or at least that's my scientific research, Don. But you're the CEO, the head of the Gulf of Maine Research. I'm sure there's more technical information there.
No, so an animal that's conscious, you know, we relate to.
Right.
And the question you're raising is a fair one. I do draw the line, though, at eating lobsters. I think it's fair game to boil a lobster and eat lobster.
Well, yeah, that was my next question, because how far do we take it? But is from a scientific standpoint, does it have to do with vertebrae? Does it have to do with having any kind of central nervous system that can respond to pain? Is that one of the moral kind of touch points?
Well, I think having a nervous system and having the consciousness to experience pain is for many people. On the other hand, you know, there's an awful lot of people that eat chicken, that eat beef, and you know, they experience pain. They have a level of consciousness. So I think it's an individual choice in a lot of ways, but there are some hard places where, you know, we tend to we're seeing shifting values, and I think the marine mammals is a good one.
Great. We have Don Perkins here. He is the president and CEO of the Gulf of Maine Research Institute here in Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O and News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Let's talk about the Gulf of Maine itself. You mentioned from Cape Cod, which pointedly is part of the name, Cape Cod. I'm guessing, and I haven't looked into the research. I guess we could kind of research it within 8 seconds on the on Google. But it was probably named for the fact that there was an abundance of cod in that area whenever it was named hundreds of years ago. And there appears to be, from the reports that I've recently kind of caught up on, that the cod population throughout the Gulf of Maine, not just near Cape Cod, has been rapidly depleted, and much of it is attributed to the change in the ocean temperature and possibly acidity, and those two things are considered byproducts of climate change or change happening in the environment. So talk a little bit about the health of the Gulf of Maine and what that means specifically with the cod population, because that seems to be getting a lot of attention lately.
So I'm going to take a step back. The Gulf of Maine as an ecosystem is in remarkably good health compared to other ocean ecosystems around the world. It's deep. There's vigorous currents that circulate water through it. It's relatively lightly populated, and there's a from a policy point of view, a public policy point of view, there are fairly strict laws and regulations against polluting it. So I think you have to, number one, it's a system
that's pretty
from a
helpful
global point of view. It's an extraordinary resource.
You mentioned something in your TEDx talk that I thought was fascinating. When people think of the ocean, at least for me, I think of it almost being equally populated with marine life. You look at the ocean, you see where there's blue, and you say, oh, that's ocean. You see land. But in your talk, you pointed out that most areas of the ocean are the equivalent of desert, where there's not a lot of marine life. And you specifically mentioned Gulf of Maine being one of the more fertile, active areas with marine life. Can you take a minute and just explain that? Like, why aren't other parts of the ocean? Does it have to do with the depth, the water temperature, food systems, ecosystems in the water? And then we'll talk about Gulf of Maine.
So that's a great point. I think of the ocean as a liquid desert. It's vast. There are huge portions of the ocean that are very, very lightly populated, because there isn't the food or the nutrients there that the things that we value, like fish, require. Along the coasts, there are areas where you have combinations of nutrients coming off the land, upwelling where a current hits, comes is running along a deep continental shelf and then hits some underwater feature and upwells toward the surface. So it's kind of like a big mixing bowl. And then it comes up shallow where you have plenty of sunlight getting into the water. And it's that combination of current action, nutrients off the land, and sunlight that kind of give you the ingredients for abundance. And so the Gulf of Maine, I think of it as an oasis in the ocean desert. The Gulf of Mexico is very productive. The Gulf of Alaska is very productive in terms of three areas that we're very familiar with in this country. And so we're blessed to have this oasis right out the front door. Coming back around to your thing about cod, cod were extraordinarily abundant. It's what drew Europeans here hundreds of years ago. They stood up to extraordinary pressure harvesting over time. We over-harvested cod in the middle and latter part of the last century. And then,
was that for oil or food?
For food. It's been primarily food. Oil is a secondary product, but it's primarily food. And I think the important thing for listeners is that over the last 20 years, there has been a constant ratcheting down of the ability to fish cod. Fishing on cod is highly constrained today. And at this point in the game, it's not overfishing that's the challenge for cod. It is a warming ocean. Cod are a cold water fish. We're at the southern end of their range, and the Gulf of Maine happens to be warming up much more quickly than most of the rest of the ocean. And so it's a less hospitable place to cod for them to recover. The other thing to take note of is that there are other species here that are doing incredibly well. Haddock have recovered from overfishing. Pollock are in good shape. Redfish. A variety of the flounders have recovered. Lobsters, of course, have been incredibly resilient. Scallops are very abundant. And so, cod is a real challenge, but there are other species that are really flourishing. And so you have to kind of take a look at the whole system, I think, and not just focus on one part of it.
But when you look at the health of the ocean, all the way from plankton all the way up to the larger species of fish, it feels like it's all interconnected. So if all of a sudden, something happens with cod, and I don't know where they fit on the kind of the ocean food chain, but isn't there a greater connectivity to the overall health of the ocean? If you lose one link, through evolution and adaptation, it may work out over hundreds of years and things shift and naturally shift. But isn't there also a big issue in terms of the whole food chain kind of being thrown off when we lose one species in the middle of the chain?
That's a great question, and I would say you're right, and on the other hand, these systems change and kind of fill in those vacuums remarkably quickly. So, cod play a key role in terms of kind of serving as the governor, sitting on top of other highly abundant and very fluctuating species of fish that they feed on. So you take that governor off and you can see other species kind of get out of whack. But then other predators will fill in that niche that was occupied by cod. I think there's several things you got to pull apart. One is, what's the general health of the Gulf of Maine compared to other parts of the ocean? Secondly, what's happening with any one species like cod? Have we spoken of that? And the third is, we're living with a warming ocean. Despite the political debate and tension around the question of climate change, the fact is that we've seen substantial warming of the planet over the last 100 years. Here in the Gulf of Maine, we're seeing the ocean warm more quickly than most of the rest of the ocean. And so we're dealing now with the question of warming, and that is detrimental to some species of fish like cod. It's actually good news for other species of cod to some extent. So squid are moving into the area because they like warmer water. Sea bass are showing up and are one of the predators that kind of fill in the niche of cod. So I think the in a sense, when we're worrying about the health of the ocean, in this country, fishing is now being highly regulated. And the real challenge when you hear about the fishery debate is, how are we going to deal with climate change?
Okay, we have Don Perkins, President and CEO of Gulf of Maine Research Institute. I mean, to your point about quotas, in 2014, it was reported that the Gulf of Maine cod quota was trimmed from about 1,500 metric tons to 386. That was a 75% cut. That followed a 77% cut 3 years earlier. So for people that may not be familiar, how does the fish quotas, who manages that? And how does, you know, because every fishery, you know, I know from the local level, a couple of years ago, I was chair of the Yarmouth Town Council, and we had a shellfish committee, and we work with the state, and the state would decide what clam flats they would open up during different times, and we had to do surveys, and we had to check the health of the fishery, and that dictated both which clam flats were opened and also how many licenses were made available, which kind of was the kind of the inventory mechanism. But who is at the controls deciding when you look at the Gulf of Maine, which different, you know, whether it's cod, whether it's lobster, whether it's shellfish, and how is that system working out? And then we'll talk about climate, which is kind of having the impact.
That's a great question. So there are three levels of control on fishing. Species of fish that live in state waters, which is out to 3 miles, and aren't mobile. So clams are a good example. They're regulated by the state, and clams in particular are then regulated by towns, as you spoke to. There are other species of fish that tend to live in near shore, within 3 miles or just beyond that, but are migratory. They tend to cross state boundaries. There's an interstate body called the Atlantic State Marine Fisheries Commission that regulates those species. So a herring is a good example of species that are regulated there. And then there are species of fish that live primarily in federal waters between 3 miles and 200 miles offshore. And those species are the white fish that we like to eat, the cod, the haddock, the pollock, the flounders. And those species of fish are federally managed by region. So the northeast region runs from, in essence, is New England, the waters off of New England. And so there are three different systems, and the federal system has been fraught with challenges over the years. It's historically, it was a very political process. The politics, interestingly, have largely been pulled out of it. It is now much more driven by the science. And the challenge is that it's very hard to do adequate science on the 19 different species in New England that are regulated by that system. It's very hard to do enough science on those species. It's expensive in order to have a high level of certainty and then manage successfully. So we're dealing with science that's inadequate, trying to manage a very dynamic system, and it's very frustrating for everybody involved.
But there's also the economics, you know. But you know, Maine, I don't know how many active different fishery types that we're dependent on, but all, you know, in the Gulf of Maine, whether you look at Gloucester or Rockport, where there's big fishing fleets. If all of a sudden the government puts down a ruling saying, hey, we're going to trim cod quota from 1,500 metric tons to 386, that impacts large, you know, fishing fleets and people who invested in boats and gear and labor. And so that has to be a big part of the discussion too, right?
It does. So if you think about the economics of fishing in New England, there are kind of four big stories. The first here in Maine is lobsters. Last year, that was about a $460 million harvest. The second in Massachusetts is scallops, and that was about a $400-odd million harvest. So the big stories, lobsters in Maine, scallops in Massachusetts. Then you have groundfish, the whitefish, the cods, haddocks, pollocks, flounders. The value of the quota available last year was about roughly about $180 million. We only harvested about $60 or $70 million of that because of the constraints on the scarce species like cod. The way the system works is a fisherman gets the quota, pounds of fish across 19 different species depending on their history. And the thing they're constrained by is the scarce fish like cod. So if they top out on their cod allowance, they can't continue to fish and catch cod. And it's tricky because all these fish tend to live together. So it's hard to catch a haddock without catching a cod. So you have this situation where we have these scarce fish holding back the fishery. And it's 120 million dollars sitting on the table or sitting in the water. It's like inventory that from an ecological point of view perfectly adequate to catch, but we can't because of the scarcity of these fish. And then the fourth part of the fish story that most people overlook is aquaculture. That's about $140 million industry in New England right now. Over $100 million of that is salmon being grown in down east Maine. The rest is primarily shellfish. And that's a segment that's going to grow over the next 20 years substantially. So the challenge is how do we sustain lobster, the health of lobsters? How do we sustain scallops? How do we sort out this groundfish problem so that we can get at the value of groundfish? And then how do we grow aquaculture as a source of more predictable fish and shellfish production over time?
Yeah, I definitely want to talk about the aquaculture because I think that's could have a huge economic benefit for Maine. But before we jump there, you mentioned there's the kind of the shoreline zone. Up to 3 miles out zone controlled by the state, and then federal zone out to 200 miles approximately. What about beyond 200 miles? What about in international waters? Are there cod out there? And is there in – what's the international jurisdiction that has control over those international waters?
So there are not cod in international waters for the most part because they like the more nutrient-rich, shallow.
Closer, yeah,
their kind of habitat requirements are closer to shore. But there are a variety of species outside of international boundaries. The billfish, like, you know, swordfish, various tunas and whatnot. And those species are managed in the North Atlantic by an international body, and it's very tricky because the quota for those species of fish is negotiated. It's very difficult to enforce because there's not an international coast guard. So internationally managed species are a real challenge.
I mean one of the more public issues that I think has kind of intersected the whole international approach is with Japan. In Wales,
mm-hmm.
You know, where there's some international court that had demanded that Japan stop killing whales, and then Greenpeace and other organizations have sent boats out there, but for some reason they're not able to stop Japan, or they agreed, and then they sent boats out last year or something like that, right?
Well, within national boundaries, you have the Coast Guard. When you go outside of international boundaries, there's no Coast Guard, and so there's no enforcement at sea, and so it's very hard to prevent illegal harvesting. And the way you control it is through landings, then the challenge is, you know, are those fish harvested internationally? Are they coming in to a country that is disciplined about restricting landings of those species of fish or mammals or not? And the Japanese and the Norwegians are two cultures that value whale meat. It's part of their culture, and you know they've persisted over time when many other countries have backed off of harvesting whales. They've persisted for cultural reasons.
Interesting. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. We have Don Perkins in the studio. He is the CEO, president and CEO of the Maine Institute. Talk a little bit about, I want to bring it back closer to Maine, and I know that for the Gulf of Maine, your zone is kind of from Cape Cod up to Nova Scotia. But you mentioned the, I think, aqua fisheries are, you know, Maine has a relatively, in my opinion, weak, kind of underpowered economy. And there are many reasons. We have 35,800 square miles of landmass. We have only 1.3 million people. We haven't really evolved from old economy to new economy. We have 488 municipalities. We've got too much infrastructure, too few people. But in all of that, one of the enduring industries and economic engines has been the ocean, whether it's connected to tourism or boating, or whether it's connected to lobster, or whether it's connected to the ocean plays a huge role in Maine's economy. Talk a little bit about the economic connection between the ocean and Maine, and then let's talk a little bit about in the future, if you have ocean area and you have lots of ocean access, and because Maine has so much shoreline. Deb, did you know that Maine has more shoreline than California?
I did know that, yes.
Because of all the edges and islands and all that. Mm-hmm. It's kind of counterintuitive.
Yeah.
Isn't it? That'd be a good game at the holiday time. Hey, kids, which do you think has more coastline? But knowing that, does that make Maine kind of well-positioned in terms of growing seafood? You know, whether it's aquaculture, or whether it's kelp, whether it's nutrients, or whether it's because if you have the natural system of seawater coming in and you have proximity because our land mass is so kind of jagged that there's lots of areas that, you know, you can kind of create tidal pool or tidal lakes where you can kind of control a fishery. But talk about the economy of marine, you know, the ocean effect here in Maine, and then what the future may hold for better economic opportunity for aquaculture.
Well, so you're absolutely right that Maine has this, we have this extraordinary coastal ocean resource. As anybody who spent time on the coast of Maine knows, it's not a straight beach like New Jersey. It is a there are thousands of islands, there are bays, there are rivers. We have over 3,000 miles of coastline in Maine, which is more than the entire, if you just looked at the East Coast or if you looked at the West Coast. I mean, there's a coast, a national coastline tucked here in Maine. And then we have what very few people realize is we have an aquaculture regulatory setup that's viewed outside of Maine as probably the most coherent aquaculture regulatory system of the 50 states. We have a quiet aquaculture industry that has been taken a lot of responsibility for itself over the last 20 years in terms of using best practices to grow fish and shellfish. And so we have, you know, from a national and international point of view, we have clean water, we have an extraordinary coastline, and we have a tradition of responsible aquaculture. So we have a huge opportunity over the next 20 or 30 years to build on that. The challenge is that the ocean is heavily used. Anybody who spends time on the water in a boat, you dodge lobster traps. There are 3 or 4 million lobster traps along the coast of Maine.
I've got to stop you there, Don, because I just bought a boat this week, and now you're scaring me. Because every time, and I'll have it in Casco Bay.
Oh, boy.
I had a boat years ago, and lobster traps love to find the bottom, the prop of my boat.
Yeah.
Just got to keep your eyes open.
I know you've got to keep, but they're
here
everywhere.
Comes Steve-O.
I know, but when you're going from Portland out to Casco Bay or going out to Peaks, there's a couple of sections where there you could almost run across the top of the lobster buoys. Yeah. And so you're right, but you've just, you know, and again, I don't want to bring it back to me, but as soon as Don was talking about, oh man, all the lobster traps, it's like, I know, and I'll be out there. I want to get out there in April because it's just a beautiful area, a beautiful scenic area.
So my point there was that the coast of Maine isn't empty right now. There's a very, very successful lobster industry out there. That said, the ocean is big, and if you think about, there's about 12 or 1300 acres of aquaculture leases along the coast of Maine. That is, I think it's 0.02% of state waters. It's nothing.
Tiny.
It's the size of the Portland jet port. That's along the entire coast of Maine. And so And that's a $120 million industry. And so, you know, to think about trebling that, if you just look at the, you know, three jet ports rather than one along a 3,000-mile coast, at that high level, it's very doable. And it's just a matter of hard work between people that want to grow shellfish or grow salmon or grow kelp, hard work connecting with the lobster industry, connecting with people who live on the shore who, you know, who bought their shorefront for the view. And you just have to go at this by communicating with other people that are affected.
What type of fish are the most viable relative to return on investment and relative to kind of a fishery and aquifer?
It's a great question.
System.
Mussels are viable. There's a growing market and interest in mussels. Oysters. Maine oysters fetch a premium in the New England and national market. Salmon is the kind of classic fin fish to be grown in cold water like this. And an interesting newcomer is growing kelp for consumption. Kelp grows very fast
in our
waters.
High protein.
Yeah, and interestingly, it complements the lobster season. It grows in the winter and spring, and then you harvest it, whereas you lobster in the summer and fall.
Interesting. Boy, I could talk. You know what I had for dinner last night, Tim?
Tell me.
I mean, how would you know, right?
Unless
you were, like, stalking me.
I could be.
I know.
You never know.
No. Katie and I went out. We saw Star Wars.
Oh, don't tell me anything. Don't
What's there to tell you?
Anything.
The good guys win. What's there to tell?
Just don't tell
Spoiler
me.
Spoiler alert. Anyhow, it's a great movie.
So did you have kelp for dinner last night?
No. my wife probably did. She's a vegetarian. She, you know, I put kale and kelp in the same category, and I'm sure it's not. But no, I had cod. I had fish and chips.
Nice.
And the restaurant I went to went out of their way to promote it as Arctic cod fish and chips,
yeah,
as opposed to other fish and chips where you don't really know.
Yeah,
you know, some Cisco factory puts in all kinds of fish parts, and they call it fish and chips, and they put batter on it.
So to that point, for those of you that are listening that are concerned about whether fish are coming from a place where they're harvested responsibly.
Right.
The common sense thing is when you go to a restaurant or go to a fish store, ask the waiter or waitress or ask the person at the fish counter, where did the fish come from? And if they can tell you where it came from, it was probably harvested responsibly. If they say, I don't know, or it came from the Atlantic Ocean, they don't know where it came from, and pick another fish.
Yeah, it came from a computer food ordering system,
right.
And who knows where.
And the other thing I would say, just to plug something we're doing, here in New England, in a Hanford Brothers and a Shaw's, we have a responsibly harvested brand and standard called Gulf of Maine Responsibly Harvested. And if you go to the fish counter in Hanford's, you'll see it there on species that are being harvested responsibly here in the Gulf of Maine. Hake, haddock, pollock, species like that.
Fascinating. We've got Don Perkins here. And Don, let's, in the next few minutes or the last few minutes, because I could talk about, I'm actually getting ready to have lunch. This is fantastic. I'm going to get myself some lunch. Don's the president and the CEO of Gulf of Maine Research Institute. He's here with us today. I are in Tide Smart. You're listening to News Talk WLOB 1310. I've been talking for, the last 5 years on the subject of climate change. And we've had folks from UMaine, the head of the climate department. We've had scientists. None of them have been politically motivated. They were scientific leaders. Deb's shaking her head here. She knows what's coming.
I do.
You know, UMaine, I think they have 72 people as part of their kind of climate consortium from, you know, cross-discipline, both in terms of the ocean. We've had people who've spent months up in the Antarctic. I've learned how to spell isotope, I think. And so I'm at a point where I believe it's a scientific fact. It's not subjective. It's not, let's politicize it, that there has been a real impact, man-made impact of carbon in the atmosphere, atmospheric, the insulation of the earth changing, the earth warming. I was in Iceland a few months ago and went traveled through three different glacier packs, talked to people there that have been there for 70 years that have never seen exposed rock because of the retreat. And so I've seen it up close personally. I haven't quite done the Antarctic thing, but the climate, in my opinion, is changing. And I don't know why. We could do a whole 10-hour show on why this has become politicized. And I think there's an element of oil, there's an element of people's economic interest kind of driving their opinions. But I have no economic interest. I'm not making money whether the climate changes or not. I just believe it's critical, and we're all traveling on this planet hurling through space 30-something thousand miles per hour. And if the Earth, if some sort of atmospheric problem happens, which I think we're going through, we're all at jeopardy. And, you know, probably not us in the room, but probably our grandkids or their grandkids. It's a real issue. So I know your area is the Gulf of Maine. So if you could talk a little bit about the specific elements of science that you look at when you look at the Gulf of Maine, whether it's the temperature, water levels, which I think are clearly rising, and then also acidity and how that changes the whole kind of chemical makeup of the ocean. What's your thought on the ocean and the impact and the evidence of climate change?
So the marine research community and the atmospheric research community, the geological communities, have been working on the question of climate change for 30 or 40 years. And the fact is that there is an overwhelming consensus in the scientific community that the climate is changing. It's a function of primarily fossil fuels. You explain the general dynamic. The first evidence or result of that is warming, and because there is so much variability in annual weather, there's variability in it. So we have, you know, last winter we had a very cold and snowy winter. This winter, so far, it's been very warm. We'll see what happens over the next 2 or 3 months. So we have our personal experience of weather, which is up and down, but the fact is the long-term trend is warming. And the scientific community worldwide does projections on that warming. There are a variety of different scenarios and assumptions. And we right now are moving along the worst of those trajectories. We're not in the middle. We're not in the happy place. We are on the really threatening side of those trajectories. So it's a real problem. Like you said of yourself, we're neutral. We don't benefit one way or the other from whether or not climate change is, from an institutional point of view. It is a problem from our point of view. It's one, I think, going to emerge as one of the serious human challenges in the 21st century. And our focus is, how do you understand it? How do you understand its local impact? Because the local impact varies. We've seen a substantial warming here in the Gulf of Maine in the last 20, 30 years. In the Gulf of Alaska, there's been a cooling cycle. So it has different impacts in different places as a function of weather systems and other factors. But worldwide, we've seen warming, and the projection is we're going to see substantial warming through the end of the century. That warming melts ice. There are huge ice caps on both poles. So the melting of ice slowly raises the level of the ocean. We're looking at, by the end of the century, somewhere between a 3 and a 5 foot rise in sea level if we stay on expected trajectory.
Which wipes out countries, islands, which could cause wars, which has famine, which is, there's all kinds of, it's not like, boy, you know, high tide's a little higher this week,
that's
kids,
right.
Be careful,
that's
don't
right.
Don't go out in the surf. It changes the makeup of the earth.
And the people, I mean, the people that are in the middle who are thinking about the future of food production and the future of the global economy and are looking at the data on the climate side, their concern is just what you said. It's, you know, how we produce adequate food in a changing environment where we've used up most of the arable land. How will we deal with a rising ocean? This is a very real challenge. And the flip side is that there's opportunity for those of us who figure out how to adapt to it. From my point of view, from a data point of view, it's just crazy to be fighting the climate change for philosophical reasons, because the data really is overwhelming. And then secondly is the opportunity. There is a business opportunity for those economies that seize on this problem and figure out how to deal with it head on.
Yeah, and Maine might have some economic benefit as ocean lanes change, and because we're the northernmost coastal city on the East Coast, that, yeah, the shipping lanes may change. So we may have, there may be some benefit to the shipping industry, which, yeah, that could be a good thing. Nobody's saying that's a bad thing, but I just worry about we're losing so much time when the head of the Senate or the Congressional Energy Committee last year, what was his name, the guy who came with the snowball into the Senate down in D.C. Do you remember that, Deb?
Yeah, I remember it. I can't remember his name.
He came in, the goofball came in with a snowball, and he said, I don't know why people are talking about climate change. I went outside and there's a snowball. And it's like, it's not about snowball. It's not about weather. It's about climate.
Yeah, but you just saw 200 countries come to an agreement. They weren't denying climate. It's 200 countries. So you got to look that square in the eye. And the other thing that we're seeing is that, you know, amongst the more conservative side of our body politic, we're seeing growing recognition of climate as an issue. So the Chamber of Commerce is beginning to look at it as an objective challenge. There are a group of leading CEOs in the country that are saying, look, this is a real challenge.
So the Pentagon is focusing on it in terms of global defense, and they have no political agenda other than, hey, we have to be ready because of it's a military issue.
So the question here in the Gulf of Maine is, how much is the ocean going to rise, and what does that mean for waterfront real estate? How much is the ocean going to warm, and what does that mean for the productivity of the fish and that we value in the ecosystem in general? How much is the chemistry of the water going to change? Again, that has an impact on fish. And then related to temperature and ice melt is, how will currents change over time? Because currents, the great currents like the Gulf Stream and the Labrador Current, they're drivers of the way our ecosystem works. So those are the questions that we need to be looking at.
They're like highways in the ocean.
That's right.
Deb, you want to weigh in on this? You've been...
I'm just fascinated.
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 Do you believe yet? I'm waiting for the pony, because we've talked about this for 5 years, and you're like, I don't know, weather is like, you know, we have cold days, we have warm days. Are you starting to warm up a little bit?
I'm fascinated to listen to the facts and have people come in who are experts and stuff, but I just don't think that we as man can control the weather of a planet.
Well, what we put into the atmosphere, we can control. Carbon levels, fossil fuel policy.
Yeah.
We could control in the 60s when we added scrubbers to, you know, dirty coal going in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
We can control that. We can.
I look forward to seeing how we do that.
Well, we've run out of time here. We may have to have a whole nother show with Don, because this is fascinating.
That would be great.
By the way, our guest, Don Perkins, he's president and CEO. The website of Gulf of Maine Research Institute is gmri.org. So any information that you're interested in, it's a great organization doing great work. Also, I would encourage you to look and watch Don's TEDx presentation that's online. I believe it's called Century 21.0, The Ocean Century on YouTube. You can just Google it. And it looks like there's a C-State lecture on January 21st. Is that right?
Yeah, we do a lecture series in the winter, spring, and then in the summer, fall. And the first one in the winter is January 21st. It's an author from New Hampshire, a book called The Mortal Sea, Fishing the Atlantic in the Age of Sail. And these lectures are an opportunity for people interested in the ocean to come in and hear from someone who's on the forefront of whatever, you know, aspect of the ocean is being featured in the series.
And that's at your offices at 350 Commercial Street, Portland.
That's right down next to Becky's restaurant.
Oh, wow. Love Becky's.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate your time and also the work that you're doing on behalf of the Gulf of Maine. And would love to have you come back sometime soon.
Thank you for having me.
You bet.
Happy New Year.
That was Don Perkins, President and CEO, Gulf of Maine Research Institute. You've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB. We'll be back next week. Thank you.